Okay, I think we're ready to start. Welcome to the, what time is it, 2:30? 2:30 panel. It's a long con already. 2:30 panel on After Edward Snowden, What Do We Do Next? I'm Kitech. I am the Vice Chairman of the United States Pirate Party. I'm also the Assistant Director of this track. Welcome every one of you. Let's introduce our panelists.
My name is Dave Moss. I am Media Relations Coordinator and Investigative Researcher at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Hi, I'm Kurt Opsahl. I'm the Deputy General Counsel at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Hey, I'm Jeff Termesazen. I used to work for a company that did audio and video recording and monitoring, and I work for a payments company. I have a master's in cybersecurity, and I'm about to start another one in international security and intelligence studies.
I'm Blair Chantel, and I'm a lawyer. I practice here in the Atlanta area.
My name's Alan Fay. I'm a director of Freeside Atlanta, a local hackerspace.
Okay, so first of all, let's start with the revelations of Snowden. Which to you five was the biggest revelation?
Probably the muscular program, or maybe the bull run program. The muscular program was when they started tapping into the connections between data centers of major internet companies. So this is after they had gotten a law, you know, that would allow them to go to these companies and try to get the information with FISA court orders. But that wasn't satisfactory. They wanted to have more, and so they started going and tapping the links between the data centers. So as it was transferring the information internally. So that was a bit stupendous. And then the bull run program, which is the attempt to make encryption with back doors, make it deliberately weaken and put vulnerabilities into encryption so they could more easily break it, which of course also makes all of you less secure because it may be that the NSA is not the only one who will figure out these back doors.
And I feel the same on those two. I think the recent one in which slides revealed some racial slurs regarding Arab American populations, I also found particularly shocking because it held that some of the assumptions we were making about how they were doing targeting, you know, really did have the connotations that it was profiling people based on religion.
I think for me it was interdiction of packages. So if you order a Dell computer, the government would intercept that package, install spyware, and send it on its way.
Go ahead. Yeah, that was the same one for me as the interdiction. I just could not believe that. That was amazing to me.
There was no particular program for me. I sort of almost had a gleeful happiness in all the jokes we'd always made coming true. That everyone's always joking, oh, they do this, and it turns out they really did do all those things, and more.
Hanging out on World of Warcraft was also pretty funny.
Yeah.
Okay, and out of those, which was the most surprising as well?
Hanging out on Warcraft, probably. Yeah. they actually have governments employing people to hang out in video games to try and listen in on conversations that could possibly be related to terrorism or whatnot. So that was surprising. I didn't expect that. But
I was surprised at the level of cooperation they got from the companies where they were introducing encryption problems. I would have expected more pushback from the companies, even if they couldn't publish the pushback, but not quite the rolling over and capitulation of like, okay, you're the NSA, we will do these things for you.
It's sort of a go slow sort of thing.
Yeah.
I just think overall that they had so much information accessible to one person that it could all be taken out, and now we all know about it. I think that was a big vulnerability.
An exploited vulnerability.
Now, how do you think it was covered in the media? How Jink Snowden and the revelations have been covered in the media?
Oh, so, you know, I do a lot of media relations through EFF, and, you know, within the first 3 days of the leaks, I mean, we were getting as many as 30 calls an hour for comment. And I was worried that after about a month, the news cycle would die and there wouldn't be any more coverage of it. But we're more than a year later and we're still seeing stories. We're still seeing debate. We're still seeing the press kind of obsessed with the whole saga. And so I think it's great. I think it's been, you know, on the whole, really, really, you know, pretty awesome. About, I think it was late 2012, I was on a panel, before I came to EFF, I was on a panel at Turcon, a hacker convention in San Diego, with journalist Jason Leopold, in which we were making the argument that, you know, hackers and journalists needed to team up to, you know, expose various things. And now you're looking around and you see, you know, computer security experts like Bruce Schneier and Jacob Applebaum and Ashkan Sultani sharing bylines with reporters, which is a fundamental shift in what journalism is and how we cover some of these high-tech issues, because a lot of journalists don't have the ability to understand coding. Yeah. So I think it's been a fundamental shift in how these issues are covered.
You think there's been any, let's say, nationalistic differences between coverage in other countries as well?
I think. Well,
RT, our Russia Today, has been very gleefully covering it.
We get a call from probably Russia Today every day. So every day is Russia Today is, you know, loves this coverage.
Yeah, we get a lot in the Pirate Party as well.
You know, something that's really interesting. EFF, along with Greenpeace and the 10th Amendment Center, which is kind of a right-leaning conservative organization, we teamed up to fly an airship over the NSA data center in Utah. And in the end, there were some 30 to 40 major stories written about it. And I used a website called Muckrack to see how much each story was shared over social media over a three-day period after we did it. And the site that got the most shares, hands down, you know, more than 3,000 shares over like the next highest one, was Glenn Beck's The Blaze. So it's pretty interesting how much the far-right media has picked up on this. But, you know, also the Russian media has been interested in it. But, you know, everything else has been covering it as well.
Okay, so we talked a little about start, so let's go on now. This panel's about what happens afterwards. So let's start with what do we think we should be doing moving forwards. Let's start politically.
I would say it really depends on what the focus is going to be. Are we looking at stopping leaks like Snowden? Are we looking at increasing transparency so that such things do not become an issue? Are they looking back at scaling back on programs that have vastly overreached where they should have been? It's really going to depend on who's making those decisions as to which way it's going to go, because once the policy gets set, you've then got to go ahead and enforce it, and then you start dealing with appropriations, with money and everything else, and the lobbyists get involved, and then it's just a lot of times what started off as a really good policy winds up being a really bad implementation. Ideally, I would like to see that we get to a level of transparency where when the government says this is a national security issue, we have some level of confidence that it is actually a national security issue and not simply a question of we're trying to cover something up or we're trying to hide what we have been, what we're doing that we shouldn't have been done, or that's just flat out illegal.
Yeah, as the old saying goes, you know, nothing to fear, nothing to hide. You know, yet right. They seem to be hiding an awful lot of stuff.
Well, they're afraid of something. Like, cops will ask you, it's like, all right, you know, if you've got nothing to hide, you know, why are you saying no? And one of the best answers I heard for that was, it says, all right, if the government reckons that I've got something to hide because I'm not saying anything, I will tell them then you guys do the same. I'll open up the second you guys do.
I know I personally would say politically, join the Pirate Party, everybody, you know. Little recruitment drive there, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of things to be demanded. There are some attempts at legislation that's going through the U.S. Congress. The most prominent of that is the USA Freedom Act that has is in the Senate right now. It's trying to scale back some of the mass surveillance. Not going quite as far as I would like, but I think it's a really good first step forward. There have also been some further attempts at transparency. A lot of companies are issuing transparency reports talking about how much surveillance requests that they receive, and we should see more of that. And unfortunately, a lot of times those companies are gagged and they're not able to tell the honest story of how much requests they've received. So it may take some legislation to enable them to be more transparent. Or the other thing we're trying to do is litigation, going through the court system to declare aspects of the program to be illegal and unconstitutional. And that's going to be a process. It's you know, one of our cases has been going on since 2008, so it may take a while. But I think I have a lot of hope that the courts will be able to scale this back and say this is too much.
Yeah, that's definitely something with the judicial standing is the issue of standing as well. You know, if you, they say it's secrets, then you don't have standing, so you can't prove it.
Yeah, well, so he's referring to what's something called the state secrets privilege, which is something the government asserts to try to kill cases in their infancy, so they don't go forward. They say, "Well, these things are state secrets, so we can't litigate these cases." And these are things that are being talked about on the front pages of newspapers, on the 24-hour news channels. They're being debated in Congress, and it seems a bit much that they're still saying, "Well, they need to treat them as secret." And so so the case can't happen. That suggests to me that they're a little afraid of what's going to happen if the court really hits the merits.
I've been actually kind of impressed with the number of judges coming forward and saying this needs to be reviewed. I know Nancy Gartner, who was the original judge in the Joel Tenenbaum case, stated that she felt the FISA courts were just way, way overblown. They had too much power. It was fundamentally unconstitutional, and they needed to be seriously reevaluated. And I really like that it's coming from the judges themselves more and more now.
One other thing that EFF is working on is on the international level, trying to get the United Nations to adopt the what we're calling the necessary and proportionate principles, balancing human rights and the right to privacy with, you know, reasonable targeted surveillance.
Yeah, I would say there are just two things, in my opinion, that would be the most important. The first is to make the process more fair, whereby these programs are evaluated. Like the FISA court is completely secret. Not completely. I mean, there's a few select people who have access to it, and that's the court that decides these huge programs. You know, it affects millions of people, and only the government presents argument. It's not adversarial, really, in any way. So I don't know exactly what that solution would be, but I, you know, having a representative for consumers or people, I think, is one option. The second thing would be more protection for people who come forward, I think, like whistleblowers, however you want to characterize them, who are really, truly trying to do the right thing and expose wrongdoing, criminality, waste, and that kind of thing. All too often, I think, you know, whistleblowing has been demonized as sort of like espionage or whatnot, and the statutes that they need to be revised and looked at again as far as that. So
I mean, the trend is going in the opposite direction. Obama himself has said, you know, implemented policies to really strike down against whistleblowers. So
yeah, there's been more espionage cases under Obama than has been espionage act since in the whole rest of history.
I don't have much to say on it, because personally I don't really think there is a political solution.
So we've done politically, we've done legally and legislatively. So let's try about technological solutions we can try and work going forwards to try and deal with these issues. So encryption.
Encrypt all the things. You know, the NSA program relies a lot, the vast majority of it, on the internet at least, is passive surveillance. They're looking at the bits as they transfer through data centers. And if those bits are encrypted, that makes it more difficult for them to passively surveil it. And if all the bits are encrypted, then it becomes an insurmountable task to surveil it, and they're going to have to go and use court orders and warrants, because they'll need the cooperation of third parties to try and get at this information. If it's unencrypted, they can just grab it and look at it willy-nilly. So use as much encryption as you can, and we're actually seeing a huge trend towards more encryption from major websites, You know, so when you're using your browser, you'll sometimes see a little lock in the corner. You know, it used to be mostly banking sites or when you're doing payment systems, but now you'll see it a lot more more places. All of Google and Yahoo and Facebook, it's now encrypted by default. And you know, with those alone, that is you know, billions of communications being encrypted.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I believe is going to happen in the next 5 years, and the only reason I wanted to be on this panel, is that hackerspaces are getting a lot of interesting technology. And I do think in 5 or 10 years at the most, it's going to be possible to manufacture hardware at a hackerspace. You'll go there, you'll be able to download open source hardware plans, be able to verify those plans, and actually build, you know, a small computer or a cell phone that you know hasn't been intercepted by the NSA, hasn't had its chip logic modified so that breaking encryption is easier, etc. And if you can put open source and verifiable software on that, now you've got a potentially pretty good secure computer. And right now we're not there technologically, but I think in 5 or 10 years you should be able to do that. Personal manufacturing, you know, I don't like 3D printers. I think they're kind of dumb. But the technology behind them is going to launch other technology that can be used for hardware manufacturing. So I think that's something to look forward to and pay really good attention to.
With the journalism community, I mean, up until about a year ago, most reporters were ignorant of any kind of encryption technology or, you know, sometimes sloppy or even, you know, very lazy about it. Now you're seeing a lot more reporters learning how to use PGP email encryption, learning how to use off-the-record chat encryption, adopting, you know, secure technologies like Secure Drop to receive records from whistleblowers, and that's something I actively encourage to. You know, if you're working with anonymous sources, or even if, you know, within your organization more often as you're, you know, dealing with sensitive stories, to actually be using some sort of operational security that will, you know, keep the government from snooping on it, or corporations for that matter.
Okay, so one last one for me before we open up to the floor. If you want to form a line here behind me for questions, and we'll get started on that in a second, or indeed, we'll go straight off, so right here.
Thank you, guys. So I had a question. We're not developing our own encryption algorithms. We're depending on companies to make those encryption algorithms for us. And I think it's occurred in the past where the government can bully these companies for the encryption keys, and some will just hand it over, and some will restrict and shut down their site. In your opinion, which companies currently, which ISPs, which encryption companies are going to be, let's say, the weakest in terms of just, you know, handing over, you know, bowing down to the government, or, and which ones are going to be the strongest actually fighting for us?
Well, who has your back, Kurt?
Yeah.
Well, one thing I just want to say is companies don't exclusively develop encryption algorithms. Those are also open source developed, and in those cases, they're open to public review and auditing. So security researchers will audit that software, and you're guaranteed that that's more or less a secure implementation. So there's a process there for that. So companies that develop encryption privately is less trustworthy than open encryption.
So what's an example of like?
An example would be GNU-PG would be an open source, open source version of PGP. TrueCrypt is also... Well,
TrueCrypt, though, they say don't trust our software anymore. Right, so. Right.
Yeah, and the problem with GNU-PG, as I was informed just a week or two ago, is it uses SHA-1, which is a bit outdated. And
can we get her question, too, as well?
But another aspect of your question was, how do you know which companies to trust? And I think, you know, this is a very important thing. On giving over the keys, we haven't done that, but we have done a survey called Who Has Your Back? Talking to about 20, 25 different companies, and we are rating them under 6 categories of how they respond to government information requests. Do they require a warrant for content? Do they give notice to the users to give them an opportunity to contest the government's request? Do they have a transparency report? So if you search for Who Has Your Back, EFF, you'll be able to find that report and look at the companies there.
We did do one on encryption as well with a similar one.
We had an encrypt the web report, yeah, that talks about what encryption these various companies are using, whether they have encryption by default and email encryption, things like that.
I'm kind of wondering what the panel's view is on, you know, whether these programs were like software or hardware that Edward Snowden he gave the PowerPoint presentation to The Guardian, and you know they still had the classification. They still had the classification markings on them. So I'm kind of wondering how you feel about that particular part of his whistleblowing, whether you think that was traitorous or whether he was, you know, whether that's an extension of his whistleblowing.
Well, I think the media in general has been actually pretty responsible about what they've been releasing. They have not just been dumping everything, in some cases, not just dumping things out there. I think The Guardian did redact a number of the items there. You're obviously going to get some irresponsible journalists, but the ones that I think he approached, it extended some degree of care in what they were releasing, at least to start with. Once they got corroboration on these things from other sources, they may have started releasing more, but it wasn't just an info dump through the media.
The thing is, though, I remember when I first saw the prison slides. Okay, they still had top secret, no foreign distribution. And right. As a matter of fact, Mr. Opsahl had one of those, and it still had the classification markings on it also. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, I used to be military intelligence. Okay, so that particular part of this whole entire thing bothers me. It's not whether the government was snooping on us and we didn't know about it. That bothers me. Okay, but what bothers me also is the fact that this gentleman, that he's, you know, he's being lauded as a whistleblower, but he did give away classified information, and the media did put it on their site, on their websites. With the classification still on it.
Yeah, I don't think there's an easy answer to that, because that's actually, we're getting into a morality question. So there are people who feel just as strongly about that morality violation versus the case for, you know, releasing these documents for another moral good. So I don't think that's an easy resolution of that, so I don't know what to tell you.
I think the debate is sort of a philosophical one, because what you're asking is like whether it is okay to violate the law out of an act of conscience. I mean, there's literature going back, you know, from Thoreau, civil disobedience, that kind of stuff. So it's sort of like at what point is sort of morally acceptable to violate technically the law?
Especially
and does it change if, you know, you're willing to accept the consequences?
Especially as it turns out classifications are being more widespread, and it's basically a classification blanket now over a lot of things. They're just throwing classification on it regardless of whether it should be classified, in order basically to hide things even if it shouldn't be. So that's the other issue, is should it really have been classified in the first place?
Well, one thing we've seen is actually a number of things have been declassified over the last year. And several of the documents that came out were subsequently declassified, and additional information was provided. So we've had, in that sense, authorized transparency as well as the unauthorized transparency that's come out of this.
All right.
I understand your point, though. It's a very important, like, it's an age-old question, basically. You know, the rule of law versus at what point, you know.
That's why I was wondering what y'all's view on it was. Whether you believed
his, you know, his moral stand, whether you believed he was, you know, whether he was right or whether he was, you know, whether it was in the law or whether you want to defend that position.
I think rather than just
defending, you know, the information that was out there.
Yeah. I mean, everybody's moral compass is different, but I personally think he made the absolute right choice. I think if you see wrong in the world, you should speak up and stand up and do something about it. Otherwise, that, I think, is more irresponsible. But that's just my personal philosophy.
And this is a sort of cop-out answer, but I think history in the end will tell. If we get legislation passed and, you know, if actual changes occur, and I mean, you have to take that into consideration.
I think also what is really important here is trying to build a society that abides, you know, by our basic rights for privacy and our constitutional rights against searches and seizures within the rule of law. And it may be that you feel that Snowden is a horrible person for having done this, but it doesn't change the information that has been revealed. And it's not about whether one person was morally right or morally wrong. If you think he was morally wrong, we still have a major problem with overreaching government surveillance that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree too.
You started earlier talking about how the media was treating this. I was wondering if there's going to reach a point where the public says, oh, we really don't care anymore, or if with a change of administration, they'll say, oh, well, that was the Obama or whoever administration's problem. This is somebody else's.
I think that'll be twofold. On the one hand, you will have politicians who will be playing up various aspects of it for their own reasons, either for party or for personal issues. And depending on what else comes out of it, you will also have media reporting on new things. The media doesn't report just to report. They report because they think there's something that needs to be out there. And after a while, if they're simply rehashing the same information, interest will die off and they'll stop doing it. As soon as something new comes out, then, or if a new angle on something that's already out there comes out, they'll be again reporting on it as they should. But a lot of times they'll be reporting more on what your politicians are saying about what's coming out than what's actually in the content.
I mean, there's a lot of people in this room who could be watching a video game costume competition right now. That's encouraging to me, at least.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't bring my costume this year. So.
You came in costume as a lawyer.
Oh, yeah.
Hi, just to continue the theme moving forward, I feel like we're at a fork in the road. Do we allow the status quo or continue surveilling, you know, letting the government overreach, or do we pull back? And so my question to you is, he said, you know, technologically, politically, moving forward. So militarily, what do you think is more dangerous, that our government have the ability to, you know, quote unquote, overreach from an intelligence perspective, or that Russia, China, Iran, and non-state actors have the ability to more securely guard their operational intelligence? What is more dangerous to, I guess, you know, Western democracy, to civilians?
Well, so I have a quick thing about that, too. The question there is, what about this haystack approach? Okay, I don't really feel secure by that. The purpose of collecting all this information is not military. It's not strategic for military, and it's not tactical for military. It's just what its real purpose is to control people, and that I don't think makes a safer world. And whether or not other nations have that capability, the thing is, if we put efforts into open hardware, open encryption, and encrypt all the things and make everybody wins. Everybody's safer. So it's not like a traditional arms race where, you know, you have bigger weapons and all this. We equalize that playing field. And so, you know, everybody kind of wins.
Well, I guess my follow-up question to that, because I guess I'm a bit confused with that statement. Your two choices are, I have the ability to secure all my information, and so does a terrorist, or all of my information is accessible, and so is a terrorist.
That's not the issue, though. We're always going to military will always need to classify some things. The catch is that when they say this is a classified item, we need to be able to confidently believe that it is really necessary to classify it, and not that they're trying to hide something that we should be able to know about.
Yeah. And I think a couple of things I want to say in just sort of reaction is one on your basic question. I think that it is more important for Western democracy to have privacy, to have civil liberties respected, that if we lose the principles that were part of the founding of this country and that are essential to our way of life, then we've lost a lot more than we would lose militarily. Second is there's a sort of a presumption. Look at their program to undermine encryption. The Chinese and the Russian that you're worried about, they could also have figured out that backdoor to the encryption program and start to spy on people through it. By having greater security over it, we are giving security and privacy to people who need it for defense. So it's not just about whether one side can spy or the other side can spy. There's an arms race going on, and it's important to say on the secure side of it.
Yeah, I think one important thing to kind of point out too is that it's not impossible to have, I guess, liberty as the catchphrase is, as well as security. Now, one example is this program called Thin Thread, which was actually rejected by the NSA, and Bill Binney, who is a lot of people think is the greatest mathematician the NSA ever had, created the program, and he programmed in exceptions for Americans. But NSA opted to just collect everything, even including Americans. So, like, you know, you kind of have to get to the point of, like, how do we affect that decision-making process? When his program was tiny percentage of the cost of what was actually adopted by the NSA. And so, like, all the interest groups had an influence on that decision. And so I honestly think that we wouldn't be here today if Thin Thread had been adopted, because they wouldn't have been up in arms, Thomas Drake wouldn't have blown the whistle, on and on and on. So stuff like that, I think, makes a big difference. So it's possible to have the technology, the strength, you know, like you're concerned about, as well as protecting people's liberties, I think.
And one of the other things that concerns me is not really part of your question, but when the U.S. does these things, when it engages in mass surveillance, it normalizes mass surveillance for the rest of the world. Now, you may have faith in our Fourth Amendment, you may have faith in our First Amendment, but other countries don't have these protections. And so when you have, you know, whatever, you know, dictator authoritarian who's able to say, well, look, America's doing this, it must be okay. And then they take that and they use that to find people and torture them and throw them in prison for the rest of their lives. You know, for the sort of things that you and I take for granted.
And of course, the final part is the actual underlying assumption in your question is that, you know, if it wasn't for these revelations, they wouldn't be beefing up their thing. It's, you know, if they're going to beef it up to as strong as they can anyway. There was a report that came out a few weeks ago that said, you know, after these revelations came out, the Al-Qaeda and all those beefed up their security and beefed up their encryption system. Well, it turned out the company that produced it was a heavily invested by the CIA, and you know the encryption beefing up had been ongoing for a while. They tried an in-house system, and then it not worked out as well, so they'd gone to a stronger system anyway. It's not like you're going to protect against to use a physical analogy, you're not going to go for a class 2 body jacket if you've got a class 4 available somewhere. You're going to go for the best possible regardless, and they're going to do that even if, you know, the weaker arms that you know and are using, they're gonna go for the best ones anyway. The revelations aren't gonna make them suddenly go, oh dear, we must change all our systems right now to this new thing, because the things we thought were just okay are now not okay, but they're bad, when we know that these great ones are already here. So that's the underlying assumption, that suddenly this revelation made them go stronger when they could have gone stronger at any time. And they would have done, because that's the underlying thought process.
Or to put it another way, every terrorist plot has been foiled by either a direct action to stop the act in progress or by targeted intelligence efforts. There's no, to my knowledge, any capture of terrorism or prevention of terrorism by collecting everyone's information on the internet.
I think from the phone records program, the one thing they came up was there was a guy in San Diego who gave a couple grand to an organization in Somalia.
Yeah.
That's it. So.
Okay.
I was wondering, I've seen some appropriations documents, they're public, and we've been working on automated keyword surveillance programs for monitoring voice communications. I was wondering if there's been any leaks about them, or if you have any information about what networks they're currently deployed on.
Everywhere. That's the first company that I worked for did that, and it's not just keywords they work on. Your current ones will also do basic just voice stress. You could say what you want and you will still be able to tell that the person's feeling something completely different to what they're saying. Active surveillance at that level is not very widespread, simply because we don't have the, or whoever's doing it does not have the computing power to monitor all of our communications.
Yes.
So there is, where it's active, it's targeted. So like airlines will run targeted communications when they're talking so they can pick up if someone phones in a bomb threat immediately. Most of that sort of thing though is handled after hours on an off-service solution where it'll take recordings made during the day, dump it to a different server, and then a portion of those will then be run through the analysis to pick out the keywords and whatnot. And if they find something, then they start going deeper. But at, there's just, we just speak too much to be able to actively communicate, actively monitor everything.
Thank you.
You guys have addressed overreach and government surveillance. What is your opinion of overreach of non-government commercial surveillance, and to the extent that that's become normalized and accepted, that we, you know, Google basically knows everything about me, or, you know, obviously Google can't arrest me yet. But do we get to a point where we have to worry about non-government entities in the same way that we would worry about government entities, basically having mass access to all our data?
Well, maybe not the same way. I mean, as you say, right, there's a big distinction between something, an entity that can arrest you and put you in jail, and it is trying to sell you things. But nevertheless, it's something that a lot of people are concerned about. And, you know, even if actually your main concern is government surveillance, if the companies have all this information, that's where the government's going to go get it. So these issues are actually very tied. One of the things that you should do and can do to protect yourself is minimize the amount of information that you're revealing. So, you know, try and block tracking cookies. You can use different you know, software programs to, we have one called Privacy Badger. You can use Ghostery, NoScript to try and reduce the amount of tracking for what you do online. And make decisions about which of the online businesses that you want to do want to work with based on what their privacy practices are and whether they're the right practices for you.
I think the biggest difference there is that the government pretty much takes what it wants. The commercial ones rely on you giving them that information. Google, all those things cannot get that information if you're not using their services. And they make it free to you because that's how they're making their money. Every time you use those free services, you're not paying for it in cash, but you're paying it by them being able to take your information and sell it to someone else and make money off of that. The government doesn't have to worry about that. They become one of the buyers in one sense, and then they've got the power through the taps, which the commercial companies don't. But most of that on the commercial side is from what you've given them and what you've chosen to give them, even if inadvertently.
I'm gonna lob a softball at you guys to talk about kind of the history of onion routing being developed at ONR, an entirely different wing of the government, becoming Tor, and then Tor being such a pain in the ass for NSA that they're trying to now double back and do that. If you have some words, that'd be great.
I think the State Department is still involved to some degree.
I think we've seen
some grants this year from the British Board, I mean, for the Broadcasting Board of Governors, I think, or whatever it is.
The So Tor is a technology that allows you, you can use a Tor browser bundle from torproject.org, and it allows you to surf the web with some anonymity. It will disguise your IP address by routing it through a variety of other servers before it gets to its destination, and it gives you some protection. Now, if you log into you know, Facebook while using it, then you know you're still giving up your information. But if you use it carefully, you can protect yourself. And one of the things that came out from the Snowden leaks was a slide from the NSA about Tor, saying Tor stinks. They felt it was too tough of a program. They are able to, at one point were able to exploit some Firefox bugs. Those bugs have since been corrected. There may be other exploits, but there's an active community trying to secure Tor and make it the strongest anonymity software out there.
Noted, Firefox is an open source product, and also when using Tor, please turn off JavaScript.
Yeah, and there's also another program called Tails, which is sort of like a bootable DVD or disk, where it's a combination of multiple programs, including Tor, where everything on a computer is routed through the Tor network, chat programs and everything. So, but recently there was an exploit to even that, I think.
Yeah.
Somebody demonstrated it at a hacking conference. But
Tails is a collection of open source software, so any of that software could have bugs. I have an onion pie that I hope to demo at Hacking 201 later tonight, if anyone's interested in that.
Hey, that's a device that runs everything through.
Yeah, it's a router.
Right.
So I'm senior in college now, and my senior project thesis has been a lot about trying to convince people to not give information freely over to these companies that make money off of giving their information away to the people. And I found through a lot of my own research that a lot of people just have complete apathy for it. They just don't care. How do you go about, I guess, y'all's opinion on how do you go about trying to convince people who just don't seem to care about this to care about it?
Well, one thing that definitely did it for me was I read a paper where just knowing a few bits of information could uniquely identify you and your movements and that sort of thing. Like if you're there was a cell phone tower hit here and you called this number, well, that's definitely you. And so I think the importance of telling people just how little information is needed to actually identify them kind of puts it a little bit in perspective. I think it's also, just the creepiness factor of being able to sell ads to, like, super targeted ads. Like, the one story that's my favorite is Target data mining to detect pregnant women before they even know that they're pregnant and sell them products. And it's a true story, and people are like, oh my god, like, I guess I am, so, yeah.
And companies run these, like, complex analytic programs on all this data from multiple sources, so they'll say, like, okay, if this person bought peanut butter, they're more likely to drive this vehicle, and then they're more likely, and they just connect everything, but just based on statistical analysis of all this data.
Yeah, from you'll vote this way.
You vote this way, right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually why you end up with the fuel discounts, because that's what they use to track them a lot of the time, is the store card. Mm-hmm. That's what they use. It started in the UK in the mid-90s, where they actually track your purchases and send you coupons.
And political parties do buy that information, because it helps them know where and how to spend their money. Because as much money as they have, it's not unlimited. And if they know that they've got a state that is absolutely going to vote for them, they'll do just a little bit there. Versus a state that's a swing state that may dump 80-90% of their available funds into that state to try and win it. And a lot of the information is based on demographic information from things like credit card sales. And credit card sales do uniquely identify you. Now, that is not sold to the political companies, but it obviously is being tracked because that's out there.
Yeah. Not all political parties, though. Certainly the Pirate Party doesn't.
Just the ones that win.
I think the more we see people having their, whatever these data, scrapers and data marketers are creating these online profiles that are full of garbage, incorrect information, and when you see people who are not getting jobs because there's, wrong information in their files, or they're not getting credit cards because of things in their files that are incorrect, people will naturally become more concerned, because it's not just their privacy, but somebody was using their computer and served something that wasn't them, and then that makes it into the whatever little profiles are being compiled by people who get paid to do such things.
Hey, Josh. I wonder about the actual motivations and goals of the overarching surveillance. Of course, they say it's all for terrorism and stuff, but it seems more likely that it's for domestic law enforcement and or more likely social control. I mean, I read a story about how they were sharing information with the DEA. I'm not sure how accurate that was.
It's very accurate.
Completely. Okay. Yeah.
It's called parallel construction.
Yeah. And what do y'all think about that? What do you think are their goals? And if it's something other than terrorism, how many concrete examples do we actually have of that?
I think the goal is to stay in power at all costs. And that's what that program exists to do. It's to identify people who dissent. It's identify people who are at the margins of society, maybe trying to change the system in some way and, you know, bring those people back in or put them in prisons. I don't know. But, I mean, it's really all about power, I think.
And I think it's important, like, for me, anyways, I try to think of it as, like, a general thing, and each person's different at the same time. So while you can't just say the government, every person who works for the government has that belief, I think overall there are a lot of people in government who kind of view it as sort of like, as Aldous Huxley said, the final revolution. If you don't know who he is, you should check him out. But he wrote Brave New World. So basically, you know, that social control, I think, is kind of what it comes down to for me anyways.
And well, for a lot of these systems, perhaps they get built with the notion of using them for terrorism, but then once you have them, well, maybe we should use it for something else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this is where the DEA program came out. Well, hey, we already got this information. Now let's share it with the DEA. The parallel construction was just a method of hiding that so they didn't have to reveal the program. So, I mean, looking at also like the TSA, you know, when they really have not, to best of my knowledge, caught any terrorists coming in through all the searching that they've done at all the airports.
They don't even catch
all the years.
They don't even catch a lot of weapons.
They found other things along the way. And
nail clippers.
Yeah. Nail clippers, bottles of water. They're able to stop that. So once these technologies exist, there's a tremendous, I think, incentive for governments to expand the use to any other issue that they're coming on, whether it's law enforcement or other things.
Yeah, I think you're right about this mission creep. One thing I talk about a lot is this, you know, there's this weird facial recognition program in San Diego right now that is, you know, funded through a DOJ grant, I believe. And, you know, these facial recognition devices are supposed to be given to terrorism liaison officers. That's the title of the type of police officer. But then you actually look at who got these things, and it's, you know, like, you know, Del Mar Park Rangers and the Department of Insurance and, you know, the San Diego State University Police, not actual people who are encountering terrorism on a daily basis. But I also have to wonder that when we have this, you know, the surveillance industrial complex, how much of this is just self-generating because of money and grants and lobbying efforts. You go and you look at who's lobbying the NSA or the Director of National Intelligence, and it's the same, you know, 10 companies, and then, you know, maybe the ACLU has reported that they were able to get a meeting with the NSA. And, I mean, you know, there's money to be spent, and, you know, it's very hard to get Congress to reduce funding for, you know, terrorism programs or crime prevention, and so it grows, budget grows every year, and so they have to spend that money, and do you see it fulfilling that way?
He mentioned prisons earlier. There are two major prison companies in the U.S. I forget the one. The other one's Correction Corporation of America.
And what, the GEO Group is the other one?
You're right. Wall Street analysts are starting to push them as a stock to watch because of the rate of the growth of private prisons in the U.S. So it's very much a business because they're both public companies. And Wall Street is now basically saying, watch these companies because they're becoming a much better buy because you're going to start making a lot of money off of these people. I think the S&P rose by like 1.5% average. These companies rose by over 7% on the one and over 8% on the other. So they completely outstripped the average, and they're just getting stronger. So there's a lot of money behind those kind of programs.
I just want to say one thing real quick. I know there's other people in line, but there's a really interesting essay by a guy named Cass Sunstein, and he kind of writes, he was actually an official for President Obama. He writes about like conspiracy theories and sort of like what what is a conspiracy theory, and it really talks a lot about people's motives. So, like, if you look at a particular situation, you know, assume that person's motives were good, you know, what's the purpose behind it? Assume that person's motives are bad. So, like, it's important to kind of, you know, be a little bit careful when you're talking about just the whole government is what's their whole thing versus an individual or who decided this decision. But he has a really good essay. I would recommend checking that out.
Okay. Yeah. What was his name?
Cass Sunstein.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks.
Hi. I was hoping you could go into some more details about political solutions to this problem of mass surveillance. And I know, I believe you mentioned the USA Freedom Act, and I'm wondering if EFF has written model legislation or if the UN's proportionate principles embody model legislation, and is there a privacy or liberty caucus amongst the Congress or in the Senate that's focused on strengthening privacy and liberty for U.S. citizens?
You can actually get this. We don't have model legislation. We have I've put commentary out on legislation that exists, but we haven't drafted our own. But the 13 principles are designed to be principles that would guide the creation of the, of legislation. So if you go to necessaryandproportionate.org, you can see those principles and some description of what they're about. And if you go to the EFF.org website, you can see our comments and analysis of the USA Freedom and actually a bunch of other bills.
Thank you.
Well, I was also going to say, right quickly, there's also been a growing trend very recently, especially in the Senate, with the revelations of the spying on the Senate reports and the spying on the Senate computers. And it's most of these senators seem to have thought nothing about it, it's fine, it's okay, right up until just recently found out they were spying on the Senate staffers and the Senate computers as well, even after they absolutely promised they weren't going to. And all of a sudden you've got the likes of Dianne Feinstein, who's been one of the big champions of the surveillance state in the Senate, and our, of course, our own here, Saxby Chambliss, who thankfully is retiring, or at least thankfully for those supporting this issue, he's retiring at the end of this session, but they've suddenly started to become a little more concerned because now they've realized they're as much of a target of the surveillance state as anyone else of it. Political change is coming because they've suddenly realized we're not immune.
One more thing on the political solution. So we do have another site up called standagainstspying.org, which ranks members of Congress based on how they voted on a variety of measures related to mass surveillance. Check it out. See who your local person is.
Maybe tweet at them. Give them a little prod, or her, a little prod, and make sure they know where you stand on it. Because if they don't know where you stand, they can't. They won't know it's an important issue, and it may cost them votes.
Hello. I was wondering if you guys could discuss the efficacy of data mining in general, and if there are any cases that you believe that data mining may be ethical.
Well, I would say a lot of data mining is ethical because it's how companies do business. The problem isn't the data mining as such, it's what they do with the information they get. It's pretty much the same thing as surveillance. The problem isn't really what the government knows about you, it's what they can do against you with that information. Data mining is not difficult. How much and how far it goes is often dependent on you with what you're willing to give up as far as kind of searches you go through, the credit cards you use, that sort of thing. But a lot of good things do come from data mining because they can target things for you and bring things to your attention that you do want to know about. It's really a question of where do you draw the line, and the companies want to draw the line a lot further than you want to draw the lines.
I think, you know, in terms of some of the ethics of it, is people have to respect the user and the user's desires, so that, you know, if someone is saying don't track me, then they shouldn't be tracked and data mined for what they're doing. If somebody says yes, you know, I we'd like you to do this analysis, you know, that's a different story. And part of the problem is that people are just not even aware of how much data mining is happening to them. There are data brokers that they do have opt-out systems. You can opt out of there. But it's really hard to do. You know, it's hard to find where the options are. Well, see, we have 5 minutes left, so we'll try, I guess, keep the next few questions and answers short.
If an individual hides behind too many, encryption levels, everything in their life is encrypted as maybe you think it should be. Do you think they would become a target? Do you think they would? Government would realize that, you know, we can't get anything on this guy. There must be something wrong.
That is known. They will just store encrypted data, and there's like I believe it's like I forget exactly what they called it, but it was like the 51% rule. If it was 51% American,
51% then, foreign.
Yeah, 51% foreign, they would collect it, and encrypted communications are considered foreign. So if you're using something like Tor, all that information is logged. They may not be able to see any of that content, but it's all encrypted.
And one of the disclosures that came out, too, was that they were keeping track of people who visited certain websites. I think one of them was Tor.
Yeah, the Tor website. Project.
So they just keep a list of IP addresses, and then all the other information out there, you can deduce who, you know, probably.
But here's the thing: if everybody is doing it, it becomes ineffective,
right?
Yeah. Right. So, and right now we've had so much of an increase in the amount of affection where, you know, everybody's communications with a lot of the major service providers are now being encrypted by default. So that means millions and millions, hundreds of millions of people's communications are being encrypted on a daily basis. So it's no longer a really an effective way of determining if somebody is suspicious if they're using this kind of encryption, because everybody's doing it with those websites. So the more and more that we have encryption, the less and less it's going to be targeted. This is why I encourage everybody to be using these products, going out there and making it part of your daily life, so that it becomes part of everybody's daily life.
One more quick one. Is there anything you regret or feel bad about that happened from Snowden's leaks? Anything you wish had not happened?
That it had been necessary. Sorry. That it had been necessary for him to leak.
Okay. Thank you.
So the biggest problem with this is that the NSA can collect all your data, all your search histories, all your phone calls, whatever. They can portray you any way they want to. They can profile you in any way by cropping that data and stitching it together. And the ironic thing is that you necessarily won't have access to all that information that you put out there. So how would you defend yourself? If you are in court and then they want to lock you up for some reason, they just painted you as this evil guy and it's not true, how can you defend yourself?
Hire a good attorney first.
I'll get you.
Wait, part of the thing is that when they first get that information, they go through the FISA courts, and in FISA courts you have no representation.
Sometimes.
Well, sometimes. If something does go through the FISA court, then they have you have no representation. It's a one-sided court. The other side never gets heard. And that's part of what the judges are complaining about. And they're saying there's no reason that a security-cleared person could not argue in defense of the information they're wanting to get. So the only time that you really run into this is once it's not just known, but it becomes a public issue, and then you run into issues like with the DEA, where they run parallel construction, and they, well, we just happened to be driving by this corner and we saw a deal going down, and you can't really argue against that because you don't know that the information actually came from the NSA to start with, to be able to argue that they used it improperly.
It's reminding me of a line from Cardinal Richelieu, who was the power behind the throne of Louis XIV, and he said, if you give me 6 lines written by any man, I can find a reason to have them hang, right? And this is the problem, is that out of context, so many ordinary people's activities can be put into a bad light. And so that's why I think it's so important to stop the surveillance and to have restrictions that would prevent them from doing that.
I think our last question now.
Hey, I wanted to thank you for the panel. It's a really excellent discussion. And I think even with all the information that's coming out, it's still, there's a lot of It's a feeling to me that it's really not clear how these processes work. For example, is everything collected, or are, you know, the thing you always hear stereotypically is that it's more like a keyword. There's certain things that flag attention. So that's what, you know, I'm wondering if this data, typically, because there is so much data, if it's just lost, you know, unless there are certain things that would flag or draw attention, or if everything is in fact collected, or if you can just, or if there's in fact other processes. That are work.
Yeah. There's a combination of that. The unencrypted stuff, they can just monitor. They don't have to keep that unless they find something they want. The unencrypted stuff, they said they were saving because the NSA is banking on, even if technology is not available now, it may be available in the future. And so with what Kurt said about ramping up everybody using it, in 30 years' time, if they've only got to search through a few hundred petabytes of data, that's one thing. If they've got to search through umpteen billions of petabytes of data, it's that much harder for them to get the information, even if they have it.
Yeah, the estimate is they take in about 30 petabytes a day. So they have a massive storage facility in Utah that recently built that can probably store years worth of data. Maybe not an infinite amount, though, unless they build some more of these. And what at least the NSA will tell you is that the things will eventually age off the system, but not before they are analyzed and they try and determine whether you've been bad or good.
Yeah, I think that's true. Like, there's a really good website I wanted to point out. It's ProPublica. If you see me after, I can give you. But it outlines all the programs, and it's a chart essentially that shows you all the programs. And as stories are breaking, they keep updating it. So really, we don't know. I mean, the NSA, throughout this whole last year, has been saying, oh, it's just this, but we don't do this, and then a story breaks, and they're like, oh, crap, you know. We just caught lying, bold face lie or something. And so, like, this website, I'll give you this printout. It's really good, so, like, EFSF has some good resources as well. Yeah. A lot of sites.
I think my question, and I appreciate that, I am familiar with ProPublica, I think my question more specifically is all of this data, this incredible amount of data being collected for potential search, or is it selectively collected?
The NSA has said that they touch only a small percentage of it. They don't really define what touch means. Okay. But it's our understanding that there are certain data points that they go through and they collect it all through those data points, and then they start to apply filters. And so some of them are automated, some of them, and eventually get to human review for a select portion of it. So like an example that came out was they wanted to find out who had visited a particular website from the country of Sweden. So they went back through their records and drew out all the IP addresses, all the communications that were in Sweden who had reached to that website during a time period. And then they would look at those more closely. And the other thing that they really want is sort of a way back machine, being able to go back in time. So if you're not interesting right now, it just sort of sits on the system and it may, through automated systems. But if you ever become interesting, then they can look back and say, what have you been doing for the last 10 years? And so they have like a time machine to go look after people who become interesting later.
Okay, so all data is collected, at least theoretically.
To the extent of their storage capacity. Okay.
Bill Benny has said that all data has been collected, but I don't believe there's a story out about that yet.
Okay. All right.
I would caveat up to this. All the data they can get hold of, they collect.
Okay. Right, that's more accurate way to say.
Can I, one more thing?
Very quickly.
I just wanted to take a picture of myself. I was wondering if I could get everyone in this front row to just cover their faces for a second.
We'll do that when we finish.
Okay.
All right. So thank you all for our panelists. If you're interested in the...
I want everyone to go like this so I can take a picture without getting anybody's faces.
Also, if you're interested in the...
Everyone right here, just real quick. Kurt, can we...
For his website.
And while he's doing that, if you're interested in the technology of it, come to Hacking 201 tonight.
Thank you.
If you're interested in the surveillance systems, we got surveillance canaries tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., and we've also got freedom of information requests at 11:30.
That's right.